This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How y'all doing today? A little later in the hour, a look at the new recommendations for screening pregnant women for depression. We want to know, were you treated for depression during your pregnancy? We'd like to get you to call in if you can. Did you struggle with undiagnosed symptoms? Give us a call at 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. We're going to get to that in just a few minutes. But first, schizophrenia. It affects about 1% of Americans. Doctors know that patients usually develop symptoms in their 20s, that a combination of environmental and genetics may play a role. But the root cause of the disease still remains a mystery. A new study out in the journal Nature now is one step closer in determining the origins of the disease. Maggie Kurth-Baker is here to tell us about that story and other selected short subjects in science. She's a science journalist and author. She joins us from Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about it. Tell us about the findings pinpointing something called synaptic pruning.
Yeah, so this is the first major insight into the biology behind schizophrenia, and they've tied it into this natural developmental process in your brain. So you're born with more connections between your neurons than you'll ever have again. Over your course of your childhood, your brain is kind of going through this process of trimming out connections that are redundant or that you just don't really end up using. So this is why it's a lot easier to learn a language when you're really young than it is to learn a language when you're in your 20s or 30s, because the parts of your brain that make the connections between language easier to learn have actually gotten pruned out as you don't use them. So what they have found is that in early adulthood, there's a lot of this pruning happening in the prefrontal cortex. It's the site of planning and strategic thinking in your brain. And the genes that accelerate the pruning process in this area are associated with the higher risk of schizophrenia. And that props up what we already know, which is that people with schizophrenia seem to have fewer connections in the prefrontal cortex than healthy people do. So it seems like something's going haywire with this pruning process and taking out a lot of connections that shouldn't be taken out.
But we don't know what that is yet.
We do not know what that is yet.
Yeah. To be determined. Let's talk about a planetary alignment happening. This is exciting. What should we look for? The planets are lining up.
Right. So if you go out now, between now and February 20th, if you go out about 45 minutes before dawn, you will be able to see Mercury, Venus, Saturn, Mars, and Jupiter all at once. And this is pretty cool, particularly because you don't need a telescope to do this, although binoculars might help, especially for Mercury. And it's just a coincidence. You know, you have these various speeds and orbits of all these planets, and every so often they just get into just the right place that you can see them all at once. It's sort of like the astronomical version of going to four corners and standing in four states at once. You can do that right now.
Yeah, well, can't they do it in the afternoon? I mean, you have to get up like 3 o'clock in the morning or something for this, right?
Yeah, 45 minutes before dawn. It's nuts.
Yeah, well, you're way up in Minnesota. Have you been able to see it? Did you get out there?
You know, Ira, I have a six-month-old, so if I am up 45 minutes before dawn, I am not doing it voluntarily.
Well, I'm gearing up for 2017 when there's a full total solar eclipse available all across the country. So I'm putting that on the calendar.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool. That'll be the first time in 38 years.
Yeah, you know, I've been counting down 5 years, 4 years. It's now next year. Next year in the summer, I think it's summertime or spring. It'll be great. Let's talk about now the growing use of neurobiological evidence in courts. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, Emily Underwood had a really interesting story in Science this week that documents the rise of neurobiology in the courtroom. And most of this has been defendants using neuroscience to effectively say, my brain made me do it. And there were 250 of these arguments that happened in 2012, and that's double the number of those claims since 2007. And it's been used for robbery, fraud, drug possession, murder. And what's interesting here is that it's rising in popularity, even though it doesn't really seem to be all that effective. You know, insanity requires you to prove that you had a complete lack of understanding of the difference between right and wrong. And neuroscience evidence doesn't really seem able to prove that. I also think it's personally really interesting because it's kind of tying into this big issue right now with science in the courts in general. A lot of forensics is being discredited, things like bite marks and hair analysis. And that's presenting some really big questions about the ability of courts to understand and make effective use of scientific evidence. It turns out that judges and juries don't seem to have a lot of skill at being able to tell whether something is scientifically plausible.
Yeah, they're even, you know, calling into question fingerprinting and whether, you know, whether that's reliable enough and how skilled the expert has to be in interpreting the fingerprint.
It's a really interesting time of change, I think, in this field.
Finally, another idea about the great mystery of why the zebra has its stripes. There was a famous poem about that years back.
Well, this is from a piece in The Atlantic by Ed Yong, and it's exploring this research about why zebras have stripes. So I think, like a lot of people, I learned in grade school or from children's books that zebras have stripes as camouflage, that they're hiding from lions and hyenas. And it turns out that this is an idea that, even though it's repeated a lot in education, isn't actually something that comes from evidence. It's not something that had ever been tested. It isn't something that we knew because of science. It's just something people had sort of assumed. And these scientists kind of set out to see what you would actually see of a zebra's stripes with the vision that large predators have. So, for instance, humans can clearly distinguish a zebra's stripes from almost 600 feet away. But if you're a lion, you have to be between 100 and 250 feet from the zebra. And at that point, they could smell the thing already anyway. So it really wouldn't be that effective as camouflage. And so we're kind of left with this space where we don't really know why zebras have stripes. There are a number of different theories, including it could be a defense against biting flies. It could also be something that helps the animals cool off because of temperature differences between the white and black stripes create little currents of air over the surface of their skin. But we now kind of have to admit we don't know why these stripes exist.
Wow, because so they're not for camouflage. At least that's what this research shows.
Yeah, apparently not.
All right, well, we'll tackle that after we get clues on how the camel got its hump. So we'll get back to you, Maggie, on that one. Thank you very much. Maggie Kurth-Baker.
Thanks a lot.
Is a journalist, a science journalist, and talking to us from Minnesota Public Radio. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And this time we're talking about the winter weathercast, right? Every day you hear on the weathercast, there's a wind chill factor, and you think you know what that is. And it's an attempt to tell us what temperature feels like outside as opposed to merely what the thermometer says. But is the wind chill factor accurate? And just how did it get started? It has a surprising history, and here with that is Joseph Stromberg. He's a science writer in New York, and his story on wind chill recently ran on Vox.com. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, what is good about wind chill?
Wind chill is essentially good at one thing, which is what it's designed to do, which is tell people the risk of frostbite on exposed skin when they're outside. So the idea of wind chill actually goes back to the 1940s when you had a pair of Antarctic explorers who did experiments freezing bottles of water outside their hut. But then in more recent decades, the National Weather Service updated the formula, and essentially it's supposed to tell you how prone you are to frostbite. So if it's 35 degrees outside with a wind chill of 20, in theory that means that your risk of frostbite is the same as if it were 20 degrees with no wind at all. And the formula is pretty good at that.
Yeah. How did this originate? What was the idea, and who did this first?
Okay, so you had Sipple and Williams, who were, you know, these two Antarctic explorers. They were Americans. And basically, the idea that wind made objects lose heat faster than otherwise was known for a while. And so their experiment, they, you know, tracked how long it took bottles of water to freeze. And based on that, they came up with this formula. And the formula, it kind of exaggerated the effect of wind. So over the decades, people updated it. But over time, it still, no matter how much it was calibrated, it still just takes into account two variables, which is the ambient temperature and the wind speed outside. And over time, meteorologists started to use it, and the public picked up on it and interpreted it as, okay, wind chill is what it feels like to be outside. But that's not really what the formula was meant to do, and it wasn't designed to do that even to the present day.
So that's really what's bad about it, then. And we're not using it. We yeah. misinterpret what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, in isolation, it's not a terrible formula, but there's all sorts of other things besides temperature and wind speed that affect what it feels like to be outside. So if you're in sunlight, obviously, that makes you feel a lot warmer than if you're in the shade or if it's dark out. The degree of humidity, whether the wind is steady or whether it's gusting, all these things make a pretty big difference. And as it happens, the most recent wind chill formula, which was released in 2005, it makes all kinds of interesting assumptions, like it assumes that your face is totally uncovered and you're walking into the wind at a steady rate for the entire time you're outside. So even if you just took shelter, you know, behind a bus stop, that's going to change what it really feels like to you. And the formula doesn't take into account humidity or sunlight, whether you might actually have your face covered up, all sorts of things like that.
And there's not even an international standard on wind chill, is there?
There's not. So there's the one, the current wind chill index, which is, you know, National Weather Service approved, and it is used in a lot of countries. But there have been attempts to improve on it. So you have, you know, private weather forecasting companies like Weather Channel and Wonderground. They have their own proprietary feels-like formulas. There was a consortium of European scientists a few years back that created something called the UTCI, which is an attempt to improve upon it using these variables I talked about, like solar radiation and humidity, and trying to calibrate it to actually match what it feels like for us to be outside. But they haven't really caught on.
Yeah, I've seen the other feels like index, the mm-hmm. real feel, things like that. There is an attempt to try to improve it because it's just... doesn't tell you.
Yeah, there certainly is. But it seems like wind chill, for whatever reason, has kind of stuck. And it's one of these statistics that, you know, in the public imagination, we, you know, give some sense of authority to.
All right, Josh, thanks for filling us in on that.
Thanks so much.
Stay warm. Joseph Stromberg is a science writer, and his story in Wind Chill recently ran on the Vox.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about screening pregnant women for depression. If you'd like to share your story, please give me a call, 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Millions of people suffer from depression. I'm sure you know that. You probably know people who do, but many of us don't even know that we do. This week, the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force, a government health panel, released its recommendations suggesting that all adults be screened for depression. However, the panel singled out one specific group for regular screening, and that was pregnant mothers. We've all heard of postpartum depression, but that could be a misnomer because between 14 and 23% of expectant mothers experience depression during or after their pregnancy, according to the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Could that number be much higher than we think? Will these recommendations get more women treated, and how do we treat depression in this population? Samantha Meltzer-Brody is the director of the Perinatal Psychiatric Program, or the Psychiatry Program, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, thanks for having me.
How are most pregnant women screened for depression now? Is it at the discretion of the individual physician?
Yes, yeah, so unfortunately, right now it's very, very spotty. And there are some places that do it quite well, and women are screened throughout pregnancy and the postpartum period. Unfortunately, in many, many places, there's absolutely no screening that occurs at all. And I think what's great about the current recommendations, the new recommendations, is that it will hopefully change that practice.
Give us an idea what a depression test is like.
Well, there's many short forms that are very easy. They often include somewhere between 9-10 questions. They ask people about mood, anxiety, functioning. They generally screen for thoughts of wanting to hurt oneself or suicidal thoughts. And it's very low risk. It's easy to administer. It takes a few minutes. One of the most common used instruments is the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. That's translated into 58 languages and is used internationally. It's also used widely in the United States, but it's certainly not the only one. It's not a matter so much of which one you use. It's just a matter of making sure it is used.
Is it something that if you go for a yearly, bi-yearly, whatever checkup your normal physician will do, or do you need to go to someone trained in how to do this?
It's a great question, Ira, and unfortunately, it is not consistent. And I think that's one of the biggest problems is that mental health is often left off the table. So again, there's some places and many internal medicine folks, OBGYNs, places that do it quite well and have it integrated into usual care. But unfortunately, at least half the time or more, women are not screened at all. It's not talked about. They don't realize it's a problem. They're reluctant to bring it up. And so they suffer unnecessarily, which causes poor outcomes for them, their children, and their families.
All right. So let's say that you get it. Your doctor does do the screening. Now what happens? You know, okay, we've determined that. What's the next step?
Well, I think what's been interesting in the field and watching it evolve over the last 15 years is that there was such concern about screening for it at all. And we know there are effective treatments for depression. There's a wide variety of effective treatments for depression, both during the perinatal period and outside the perinatal period. And screening is the first step to identifying who is sick and then moving towards effective treatment. If we don't screen, then we essentially just decide we're going to turn our head the other way and pretend it's not there. And we would find that unacceptable for any other organ system in the body. We wouldn't say, you know, we don't have a cardiologist around, so let's just not check someone's, you know, blood pressure or check for heart disease. And so one of the excuses has been there's inadequate mental health providers in many places, which is true. But I think as a society, we have to embrace the fact that mental health is critical to health in general. And that for pregnant and postpartum women, it's particularly critical because it's such a profound and vulnerable time. And that screening is the first step to figuring out who's sick and who needs treatment. I hope these new recommendations by the U.S. Services Preventative Task Force will force the issue so that it's no longer acceptable for us to ignore this for our mothers.
Let me go to the phone, see if I can get a call or two. Let's go to Dallas. Tina, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
When I had my first child, went in for a regular appointment afterwards, and we went through the regular, you know, checkup procedure. And then she asked me, "So, any crying?" And I immediately started crying and said, "Yes, a lot of crying." I thought that was kind of normal. And she goes, "No, it's, you know, a little bit, but not a lot." And so she gave me a survey and asked some questions that I answered. I scored well enough to where she was concerned, or bad enough to where she was concerned. And I went on medication. And the next time I came in, she kind of asked me, "So how are you doing?" I thanked her profusely because I didn't realize how badly I felt until I felt better after having started taking medication. And it, you know, I just am so thankful for that question. So any crying? I'm so thankful for that question that whenever, you know, I have a friend that, has had a child or, you know, I always say, "So any crying?" Because it's just such a simple question, but it really, I think, really changed my life. I don't know that I would be, you know, okay today if I had continued to struggle with depression after my pregnancy. And so I'm just and I didn't know I had it. So I'm just so very thankful for that question.
Well, thank you for your call. You're also saying, though, Dr. Meltzer Brody, that this could happen during the pregnancy, not just after, in her postpartum story.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you called in and shared that, because that's exactly how we hope it will go. So the prevalence of depression for women at any time in their life is at least 10%. There seems to be the highest point prevalence is in the first month after delivery. But women get depressed during pregnancy, women get depressed postpartum, and it is such a vulnerable time. So when people get sick, it can have devastating consequences. And what we want to have happen is that people are screened throughout pregnancy and postpartum so that they can be identified and then effective treatments can be offered. One of the lines of research that we're doing at UNC is that we're really interested in moving beyond just screening of who's already sick to moving towards a prevention model. And a lot of our research is focused on genetic and underlying biomarkers. Ideally, we hope one day to be able to prospectively predict who's at risk of getting sick, and then to intervene before they do. And so while screening is great, moving towards a prevention model one day would be even better.
You know, you're talking about, she was talking, caller, about medication after she was, after she had delivered. You know, people are afraid to take anything while they're pregnant, you know, from alcohol to anything else. Are there safe medications for depression to give pregnant women?
Well, it is always a risk-benefit ratio. And so untreated depression has many unfortunate consequences. I would say that treatment during pregnancy is always something that must be carefully considered. You always need to review the severity of symptoms, past history. But there are effective treatments for depression, certainly psychotherapy. There's many different kinds. And yes, medications can be used during pregnancy in women for whom the severity, their history, or other factors dictate that that is the right thing for them. You know, we give antibiotics, we give many other medications for other health conditions, and there are always risks associated with taking a medication that has to be weighed against the risk of not being treated.
What if you say to your doctor, you know, I'm not feeling well and I feel depressed, and doctor says, oh, you're just pregnant, you're not feeling good, you're not sleeping, that sort of stuff. What's a woman to do then?
Well, unfortunately, women are often, for lack of a better expression, blown off or patted on the head historically and said, you know, now, this is just normal. Pregnant women have these concerns, or new mothers have these concerns. And it's devastating. I just saw someone recently who lives in a different state who was given that information and continued to get sicker and sicker and felt that there was something the matter with her. So I think that If the recommendations of the task force will make that no longer acceptable behavior, and that I hope it will force all providers caring for pregnant and postpartum women to screen, which will then hopefully force the issue that there have got to be effective treatments offered. And there's many people doing brilliant research across the world looking at all different kinds of effective interventions. Mm-hmm. We are now at a really exciting time because of mobile technology and digital tools. We have the ability to reach people and deliver both interventions using digital technology, but also to conduct research in a large-scale international way to understand all kinds of things, including understanding the underlying biology or the genetic signature, to deliver treatments to people who are living in places for which there's not a local mental health provider. So I think that given the amazing tools we now have, there's really no excuse for us to not move forward in a really productive way.
Well, let's hope this new study recommendation does help women move forward and help doctors help them. Thank you very
Absolutely.
Much. Absolutely. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Doctor. Samantha Meltzer-Brody is director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We here at Science Friday have a special affinity for cephalopods, in case you haven't noticed, including my favorite, the octopus. The octopus likes to live alone and has been able to be asocial, not interacting much with others of its kind. But new research published this week says that at least one species of octopus uses its special talents at changing coloration and postures to send signals to other octopuses, sort of an octopus pantomime. David Scheel is a professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage and one of the authors of a paper on the findings published this week in the journal Current Biology. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're quite welcome. What do these signals look like?
They're kind of flashy, actually. The octopuses turn dark, stand up very tall, spread their arms and web very wide, and then they raise their mantle, which is sort of the body sac behind the eyes. They raise that up above their eyes, and then sometimes they will even seek out high ground to do that display on top of from a high point.
And what does that signal mean?
Well, we think it means I'm not going to back down. I'm this big, and I'm here, so watch out.
Are you surprised that they do this?
Some of it's surprising, yeah. As you mentioned, we do tend to think of octopuses as solitary. If they're going to get together, it's either for mating or the big one's going to eat the little one. And it's a surprising sight that we're working at because the octopuses coexist there for some time.
You know, humans do things that other people can see that may not have evolved to convey information, like blushing, right, and embarrassment. Could this be just an involuntary reaction?
Well, we did consider that possibility, and some of it possibly. But for example, the octopus that's approaching and seems kind of wants to hold its ground, that one turns dark. and may give chase if the other one runs away. And the octopus that's going to yield ground turns very pale or puts on what we call a dematic display, which is a pale color with high contrast dark patches on it. And so now we have a chasing octopus who's dark and a fleeing octopus who's pale. And it's hard to think of a physiological reason why chasing towards something would turn you dark and chasing away from something would turn you pale. So it does seem like this is some sort of signal.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking about octopuses with David Scheel. I mean, we've talked about octopuses. They are so unique. I mean, in things that they can do. We have videos of them walking. We have videos of them in their camouflage. Is it possible that they could, sometimes they throw things, I understand.
Yeah, we have seen that at this site. We're still working on that a little bit, yes. The thing about the octopus is they're kind of the universal animal. They can do a little bit of everything, it seems like.
Yeah. Can they change, can they fight off two different things at once? Can they make one side of their body get that dark side and one side remain pale at the same time?
They do. We haven't seen dark on one side and pale on the other, but what we have seen at this site is a retreating octopus will give the pale signal on the side of the body facing the approaching octopus, and on the other side of the body, it will maintain a fairly neutral color that's pretty close to the background in color intensity. It's a bit like the zebra looking gray in the predator's eyes. It maintains that gray color that probably from any distance at all matches it to the background.
Now, I know that you spend hours and hours watching octopuses. Are there any signals you're seeing that you don't know what they mean yet?
There is an interesting one that's very common. When one octopus approaches, often it will reach out an arm towards another octopus, and then the other octopus may reach back towards the approaching octopus. And we don't really know what this is. They don't always touch. Sometimes they do. And very often that's the extent of it. An octopus will walk across this area where we're studying, and three or four other octopuses will reach out an arm towards it and then withdraw the arm. And we don't really understand what that is yet.
Do they have like a favorite arm, like you're right-handed or left-handed? Is there one tentacle or arm that they use more than the others?
They definitely are using their first left or right arm for this reaching behavior most commonly. There is a study that shows handedness in another species of octopus, but we haven't looked at it at this site yet.
So what's the next thing you would like to study?
Oh, there's not just one.
Well, I've only got 2 minutes here.
Okay, so yeah, I think the next step at this site is to try and look at how the signals function in different contexts. Right now, we established that there is some signaling going on, but we didn't establish what kind of context it occurs in. And so maybe we're going to look at their mating system, their foraging behavior, and try to understand what's the context in which this signaling is most common.
We talked about them, being isolated. They like to be loners. Do they ever find them living in groups?
They are here, and we think that's because this is a little bit of shelter in a big sea of food, and so it's a great place to hang out, but in order to do so, they have to tolerate each other. There are groups that have been found in another species of octopus and some displays occurring during mating in yet another. So in this paper, we found that there are hints that there might be social interactions in at least 12 species of octopuses already in the literature.
Yeah, they're certainly fascinating. As a scuba diver, I have encountered them underwater, and they're just so interesting to just sit there and watch. Thank you, Dr. Scheel, for taking time
to
be with
us
today. David Scheel, professor of marine biology at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage, and he was one of the authors of a paper in Current Biology. We're going to take a break. When we come back, a look at how political bias can shape your relationship. I mean, if you go out on a date or you meet somebody, do you immediately ask them who they're voting for? And is that, make you want to talk more or less to them without even asking anything else? It's getting to be more like that. So we'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know that we love the microbiome here at Science Friday, and so it's probably no surprise that we'd eventually turn the macroscope towards that topic. And here to tell us about it is Luke Groskin, our video producer. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Welcome. Let's talk about this, the microbiome video.
Oh, okay. So our video today looks at how we are surrounded by an ecosystem of our own making. We are constantly shedding skin and particles and bacteria. When you touch your hair, when you touch your clothing, you know, we're resuspending these particles billions at a time. And that all forms a cloud, a microbial cloud around you.
So both of us now here, sitting, there's a cloud like, who's the Peanuts character?
Pigpen.
Pigpen, yeah. Like it had dust around it. We have a microbiome.
Yeah, and not only do we have a cloud, it's a unique cloud. It's your very own microbial cloud, Ira. That's right.
I feel better now.
Right? So our video looks at how the biology of the Built Environment Center at the University of Oregon plopped a person in a room, a specially sterile room, and they controlled the airflow, the temperature, and they asked people not to shower or to use any products. Then they collected the air in that room from filters and from petri dishes, and they found, looking at the DNA of the microbes inside, that the bacteria that they collected, that, you know, you could detect a person just by having that person sit there, just by their microbiome that was floating around them. And they could distinguish it from other people's microbiomes. We have our own very unique microbial cloud.
So we're basically, what you're saying, leaving behind bits of our microbiome wherever we go.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So this is mostly skin and oral microbiome. But they also found, as you might have guessed, some gut microbes. They found microbes from people's genitals, or typically associated with people's genitals. They found, you know, now before you freak out by all this, just remember, these are healthy. Most of these are healthy microbes.
Yeah.
This is part of a normal microbiome. And we're all surrounded by it all the time. So don't panic. You know, this is how the world works.
Because we had a video last week about finding microbiomes in the subway.
That's right.
Right. We were leaving pieces of it on the poles and whatever.
Yep. When you touch a subway, you know, when you're strap hanging or anything like that, you are leaving your microbiome. But you don't even have to touch anything. It's floating off of you at all times.
And so they put people in a room. I guess it was a sort of isolated room in your video. And they then watch the cloud come up.
That's,
and they could test for the microbiome.
Well, you can't see the cloud. In
no,
our video,
that's
we,
good.
Thank goodness, right?
No.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they did. And it was. I asked them, you know, could you pick somebody up out of a lineup using this? Mm. Could you use this as like a forensic fingerprint of something? They're not there yet. They've only done 12 people, but they were able to distinguish between those people. Some people gave off more microbes. Some people gave off less. And they want to know, what are the factors that influence this? Like, does, you know, how much washing and products change this? Does having a beard change it? Certainly your gender absolutely changes it. And they want to know how far it spreads. Does it mingle with other people's clouds? Are there, you know, how, you know, will it go across the room, or is it just landing just directly around you?
Wow. And so are they going to actually answer these questions? Are they going to try to figure these things out?
They have another round of the study that they're using in this special room, bringing in dirty people and putting them together and seeing where their clouds go.
I know this is we talk about this a lot. This is so fascinating for us about the microbiome.
Yeah, and this week actually is what we're calling Microbiome Week. So there's a whole bunch of videos. If you go to sciencefriday.com, you can see not only our videos, but you can see videos from the American Museum of Natural History, from two web video series called BrainCraft and Gross Science, and we've all made videos about the microbiome. And if you're really interested in this, head to Science Friday and check it out.
There it is, our little microbiome update up on our website at sciencefriday.com. Luke Groskin, our video producer. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
If you've ever given online dating a try, you know there are lots of ways to filter out the potential matches. Smoker, you smoker, non-smoker, deal done. Now, more and more, that key filter is becoming one's political beliefs. There are even politically based dating sites that'll help you find your running mate. Do potential partners' parties match? That's it, you know? We went out to Times Square to ask people how much politics matters in dating, and would they consider dating someone with different political leanings?
There's, like, major issues that, like, you would disagree with on an everyday like level with someone. So I think, yeah, it definitely does play like a role. I think it depends on like the issue.
I'm completely couldn't date someone that didn't have the same political views as me.
Oh yeah, why not?
Because I find conservative views really ignorant, and I guess they're inherent in my morals. It was the way I was brought up, so there's no way.
So no crossing that line for you.
Never.
Okay. Yeah, that was Christine from Westchester and Jen from Perth, Australia. We're used to hearing politicians play up the partisan divide, especially in this election cycle. But how does that divide play a role outside of the polls? Shanto Iyengar is a professor of political science and communications at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
It makes sense that people would want to date or marry someone that share the same political beliefs, but it always hasn't been this way, has it?
That's right. In the good old days, at least in terms of discussions of polarization, so let's say we go back to the 1950s, the 1960s, party affiliation made virtually no difference to interpersonal relations. And so there's a well-known survey question that people were asked, how would you feel if your son or daughter were to marry someone from the other political party? Democrats would be asked about marrying into the Republican Party and vice versa. And less than 10% of Americans felt troubled or displeased by the prospect of inter-party marriage. 30 years later, around the late 1980s, the mid-1990s, we began to notice a slight change, well, a dramatic change. More than 25% now say that they would be troubled by the prospect of their offspring marrying outside the party. And as you pointed out in the in your lead into this segment, if you actually look at spousal agreement, if you look at marriage across party lines today, it's extremely infrequent. Maybe 10 to 11% of American couples actually have divergent party registrations.
And is this part of, you know, there are so many dating sites. Do they ask this now on the dating sites? They match
you
by your
actually,
party affiliation?
No, you're free to, you know, construct your own profile. And there's actually quite a bit of research on what people put out there. And not surprisingly, people are fairly strategic. That is to say, they do not advertise their political views. So it's not as though they are proclaiming themselves to be, you know, conservatives or liberals. They're making it difficult for prospective matches to find out about this. And so despite the level of difficulty, people manage to uncover it. So it's indicative of how important this attribute happens to be. People are actually going out of their way to get this information.
Now, you set up a fascinating study that tested partisan bias in an area that should be completely out of the realm of politics. And I'm talking about the bias, how it might affect scholarships. Tell us about that.
Well, we asked people to judge resumes. We gave them a couple of resumes of high school seniors, and we were interested in the degree to which extracurricular activities might trump academic credentials. And so we manipulated the high school kid's grade point average. He either had a 4.0 or a 3.5. Then we also manipulated other attributes. So we gave them a prototypical African-American surname or a more Anglo surname. So we manipulated race. And we also indicated that maybe he was the on the resume, he was the president of the Young Democrats or the Young Republicans. So we provided cues about partisanship. And it turns out that, well, the task of the respondent was to select one of these two candidates. And it turns out the party cue dominated. It dominated credentials. It dominated race. It dominated gender. So people were basically going out of their way to penalize the kid who happened to be active in the opposing party.
So they were choosing scholarship based on party affiliation.
That's right.
Wow.
To a remarkable degree.
Wow, that sounds like a serious problem.
Well, I mean, the issue is that, you know, we live in an age, as Donald Trump is fond of reminding us, it's an age of political correctness. And so when people are asked questions about race or gender or age, and they are asked to offer opinions about members of racial groups or gender groups or religious groups, they are not very spontaneous. They feel constrained. But when you're asking people about Democrat and Republican, they feel no, they're not worried about saying, you know, they feel free to say all kinds of bad things about their partisan opponents. Well, the social norms just don't apply.
Well, you know, it seems like maybe it is good. The good news is we've come far enough that race doesn't count as much as your political affiliation anymore. You know, it's not.
Well, that's that would be an optimistic take on it.
let me ask you a couple of other things. What about I know this, you may not have tested for this, but when I remember when I was dating, and one of the most important things you wanted to know from somebody that might be a deal breaker was whether you were a smoker or not. Right? You're going to live your life in a house with someone who smokes or you don't smoke. Does politics even trump smoking?
Well, that's, smoking is a pretty difficult attribute to conceal. It's fairly transparent. Politics is not all that visible. I mean, it's true that you know, quite a few Americans display their partisan preferences. They have bumper stickers or yard signs. They certainly express their opinions on candidates and issues, but it is smoking. I would say is just far more pervasive as a sort of a attribute.
So what you're saying is that if you want to be socially active and meet people, it's best to hide your political affiliation.
Well, you certainly don't want to go out on a limb and advertise your preferences on climate change and abortion and Donald Trump and what have you. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. And is this purely? Let me just remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with a very interesting scientist, Shanto Iyengar, about politics now trumping, so to speak, no pun intended. Everything else that people think about, is this an American thing, or is it true worldwide? Do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question, and we were curious about that. And so we've actually begun some work into other societies that are actually quite divided. We think of America as being a polarized society, but we're actually not as polarized as several other countries. So, for example, we've been looking at Spain, where we have separatist movements in Basque country and Catalonia. And we've also been looking at Belgium, where, you know, there's a big divide based on language, French speakers versus the Flems. And it turns out in these highly divided societies, where they're divided on grounds other than politics, we have sort of replicated the American pattern. We find that that in Spain and in Belgium, the party divide is quite intense and competes with these other very salient social or ethnic divides.
Mm-hmm. If
people, so it doesn't seem to be a distinctive, uniquely American phenomenon.
If people are going out of their way to hide their biases this way, would they possibly also hide them from pollsters, not telling them the truth about what they've just voted on or where their biases are?
Well, on sensitive subjects, there is some evidence that people are less than completely honest in their poll responses, particularly on, there was this famous Wilder effect named after the African-American governor of Virginia. So when people are asked whether they are going to support an African-American candidate, they might say yes, because they believe that is the socially appropriate thing to say. They're advertising their openness, the fact that they're not racist. But in the privacy of the polling place, they might do something else.
Well, that might be a lesson for this next coming election and primaries coming up about what people will say and what they will hide. Thank you very much, Dr. Iyengar, for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Shanto Iyengar is professor of political science and communications at Stanford University. One last thing before we go. Marvin Minsky died this week at the age of 88. He was a pioneer in artificial intelligence, but his interests were wide and varied. And back in 1992, he was a guest on this program talking about the rise of nanotechnology, a new field. And he offered this thought to a caller who wanted to know how to break into this field.
If you want to do the latest thing, it usually pays to work sideways. You want to learn mathematics and physics and chemistry and computer science. If you start right in on it, you'll probably never get up to the front. And this happens in a lot of fields. There's another very exciting field called virtual reality that's become worldwide popular. Students are always saying, how do I get to do that? The answer is to learn a lot of science and a lot of critical thinking and art and so forth. Don't aim right toward the thing. I don't think that's a good idea.
Marvin Minsky died this week at the age of 88. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our Lex Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Graskin is our video producer. And we also had help today from Ella Feder. Rich Kim is our technical director. And Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or smartphone to our website at Science Friday. Yeah, you can also join our mailing list, and you can podcast the program anytime you'd like to. And if you're looking for weekend reading, the Sci-Fi Book Club is in session. We're reading Oliver Sacks' autobiography, On the Move. Sacks was wealthy in friends, from poets to neuropsychologists. So meet a few of them at sciencefriday.com/influence. It's our book club selection this week, and we're going to be getting the book club back in order after we read it. It's a great read. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.